Would you like to write code faster and smarter with rich code completion and clever code analysis? Find anything in a solution instantly? What if you could easily explore and run tests, work with Git, Mercurial, or TFS seamlessly, and refactor in a few clicks? All this and more is available in JetBrains Writer, a .NET IDE for Windows, Mac, and Linux. Try it free for 30 days. Get Writer today at RIDERIDE.net. That's RIDERIDE.net. This is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Yasmin Salem Hamdan. She's a lawyer at YSH Law Firm. And I found you on Instagram at Startup Lawyer Lady. You're very technically savvy for a lawyer, if you may forgive me saying that. I get this impression that lawyers are faxing things and doing things with regular paper.
I hate to break it to you, but many of us still are. But some of us are trying to, as you could say, get with the times. So yeah, I pride myself in that.
Why is it that we, like the public or the techies in the public, have a feeling like lawyers are like stuck in the past? And we hear about like people still faxing stuff, but there seems to be a new generation of lawyer that maybe is getting more technical.
Yeah, you know, I wish I could. I wish I had an answer to that question, Scott. There are. It might be a matter of. I don't know. A couple different factors are coming to mind. So the law itself, you know, the practice of law and the law that's on the books. I mean, that takes a lot of time for it to change and to catch up. And so technology moves so quickly, and the law and legislation itself, in order for that to be enacted and, you know, just proposed in general and goes through the process that it is required to go through, that takes years, you know. And as you and I are both familiar with technology in a general sense, it moves very quickly, right? So technology from a year ago may be outdated at this point, right? Whereas there are laws on the books from 30 plus years ago. Some are still applicable and some are not. And that's just sort of the nature of it. And I'd like to think that, you know, the law will catch up, but the practice of law certainly has changed a lot in the last, you know, last decade, certainly in the last two decades, I'd say. The practice of law itself, with the introduction of technology and the use of the internet, and certainly social media with marketing in recent years, that's just transformed the way that clients and attorneys are communicating. And so, yeah, I came in at a pretty good time, I'd say.
One of the things that I've noticed as a consumer of legal services is, in the last maybe decade or so, the thing that's most significant to me is the idea of digital signatures, you know, using DocuSign and things like that. Did that just happen because the industry demanded it, or was there some like precedent or something where it's like, yeah, this person clicked on this PDF, therefore it's their signature? Like, when did that decision happen? Or someone said that was a thing.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure when exactly it happened. I would say my guess is that it happened in the age of the internet. But it's interesting that you bring that up. Is it just because somebody clicked on this PDF and that means it's a signature? I remember back in law school when I studied estate planning and development of wills and, you know, trusts and things like that, for individuals, there is some sort of statute in the state of Texas where if that individual just creates some sort of marking, it doesn't necessarily have to be their actual signature or even their name. It could be some sort of marking, and that constitutes as a signature or, you know, authorization, if they're granting authorization or whatever it might be, agreement to a contract, if it is a written agreement. And so I think the market demanded it because of, you know, faxing becoming a thing of the past somewhat. I don't own a fax machine, but I know most law offices do have fax machines, and courts still use fax machines. And when I deal with a court and they don't use email, I'm like, how is this possible? But it is, right? And I think it's also a matter of investing, you know, the resources in bringing things up to date, which, hey, in their minds, it might be a matter of, if it's not broken, we're not going to fix it. You know, it works just fine. Everybody knows how we operate. We'll keep doing it until we can't anymore. And
yeah,
I guess nobody's objected at this point. So yeah, I don't know when that came about, but that's a great question.
Yeah. I find it comforting that you don't have a fax machine. Somehow I just imagine that y'all are faxing when we're not looking.
You know, there have been multiple times where I'm like, do I really need to get a fax machine? But I haven't yet. So I've made it this long without investing in a Ring Force, rather, to purchase a fax machine. But
yeah. And then it's so ridiculous that sometimes they'll make us like do like an e-fax. And it's like, really? I've been all this technology just so I can end up giving you a fake piece of paper.
So many ways we could communicate. And this is your method of choice. So.
Hey. So one of your specialties at YSH Firm, at YSHfirm.com, is helping people out with their startups, with their ideas, you know, all the legal support when someone has an idea and they want to make that thing happen. And I realized that if someone quizzed me and said, what's the difference between a trademark, a copyright, and a patent, I would probably have a very long, awkward pause. And it'd be like, well, I mean, a patent, that's like the most important thing. Maybe you could help me understand those things.
Yeah, absolutely. So those are the three main types of intellectual property. So as far as, we could take a step back, the difference between intellectual property and real property. So real property, those are tangible things like, you know, maybe it's a building, maybe it's personal property, maybe it's a piece of land, you know, things that you can touch and see and feel, right? Now, intellectual property, that is more so intangible. So we've got those, like you mentioned, Scott, we've got patents, we've got trademarks, we've got copyrights. So patents are rights that are granted to the original inventor of the invention by the U.S. government, and it gives that owner the right to exclude others from using or profiting from that invention. And it's a limited period of time, right? So there isn't a perpetual grant in the right to create whatever intent or reproduce it or use it or profit from it. I think in the U.S. it's for a period of 20 years, okay? And so after the 20 years, it's sort of a free-for-all. But for that period of 20 years, that individual, that inventor, has the right to reproduce it, profit off of it, import it from out of the country, you know, really just have control over the use and the reproduction of that invention. It's got to be something that is novel. It should be non-obvious and non-functional. And so I'm not a patent attorney. These are each of these areas, and I'm going to go into copyright and trademarks in a little bit. Each of these areas are very complex, as you can imagine, right? So my focus is on trademark law. And that's really where I work with my clients in developing solid trademark assets and then taking the steps necessary to protect them. Okay. And so what a trademark is a source identifier. And so as a business, as a startup, as a brand, you have source identifiers that you're using in commerce to identify the source of the goods and services that you're selling. And so a good example I like to use is Nike, because everyone recognizes Nike. We're all familiar with the brand Nike. Nike is the brand name that is their trademark. They're using the wordmark Nike to identify the source of the goods that they sell. Another trademark they have is their logo, and that is that swoosh symbol, right? The check mark. You see the swoosh symbol on a pair of track pants, or you see it on, you know, a shirt or a basketball or whatever it might be. You automatically recognize that the source of that product is the company Nike, right? And you associate certain things with that. So you associate a certain level of quality, right, with a brand and with that product when you see the trademark on, you know, the product is bearing that trademark and connecting itself with the source, which ultimately here is Nike. And then, you know, they've got their slogan, which is another trademark, which is Just Do It, right? We're all familiar with that. You hear Just Do It, you see Just Do It, you automatically associate whatever it is that you're seeing that on with the company Nike. And again, you're, that brings to mind, you know, a certain level of quality, maybe of philanthropy and whatever that might be. And so that's really where I focus my energies and my time in working with my clients. And we'll talk more in depth on that in a little bit, I'm sure. But the third kind of piece of intellectual property is copyrights. And so with copyrights, that is the rights and the ownership in an original work of art or authorship. And so the kinds of copyrights that you might have within your business might be photography, videography, written words. So if you've got a blog, if you've got like yourself, you have your podcast. So you have ownership in the audio files, the recordings. These are original works of art or authorship. And so as a copyright owner, you have the right to reproduce it. You have the right to create derivative works based on it. You have the right to, you know, authorize others to use it or benefit from it or reproduce it. And so that means you could license it to others. You could develop derivative works in terms of if you have a podcast recording, you could create written works based on that, like a transcription. You could develop maybe graphics based on, you know, including the quotes that you're pulling from these recordings. And so it's a wide range of rights that you have as the owner. In the law, they refer to it as the bundle of sticks. And so you could always separate the bundle of sticks. I might decide, like, I'm going to grant you the right to license this to others, but I'm still going to maintain ownership over the copyright. And so, yeah, so you can, you could probably imagine how all of these assets are valuable within a business and within a startup, and how you want to make sure that you're taking the steps necessary to protect your assets from infringers, because as I'm sure you know, people start popping out the woodwork when you create something, you know, fabulous. They want to reproduce it. They want to, you know, replicate it. And they try, but you have to make sure that you're enforcing your rights. And that way your rights don't become diluted.
Okay. So then in order to have copyright protection, something must be original. So you and I are on this podcast having a conversation, which is presumably original. So it's a tangible medium, where that tangible medium is this MP3 that people are listening to right now. It's in a fixed form. I can make it a transcript or a book or whatever. But you're talking the most. I'm hosting the podcast. You own your words, but I own the copyright, even though you're saying cool stuff. At what point could you and I have a big fight and you could say, hey, Scott, stop talking, you know, stop making t-shirts about something that Yasmin said on the podcast that was really amazing?
There's a lot of gray area in the world of intellectual property, right? So let's say you created a t-shirt and you've got this t-shirt design and you develop the design, but the words are mine. And so then the design, you have copyright ownership in that. But the words, if they are original words that I, you know, strung together, I guess you could say.
Right, but you dropped the knowledge on this show, right? Not just randomly when we were having coffee, but like while we were recording.
Yes. So the recording, since you developed the recording, you would have presumably copyright ownership in the recording. Now, I have some clients that are have podcasts, and we develop contracts that make it very clear who owns what, and that as the podcast producer and host, that you are granted a license from me as the guest, you know, to reproduce, you know, these, you know, the recordings and to reproduce the content that we've discussed, and that is, you know, here in this tangible medium. And so, yeah, it's the best case scenarios. You want to make sure that all parties agree so that you are clear on what your rights are and you don't find yourself in some hot water later on where you might say, okay, well, you know, Yasmin said some really cool things I want to share with others because I think it'll be useful to them. You want to make sure that Yasmin has granted you the right to do so. And then that way I don't come back later on and say, well, wait a second, you know, you're making a lot of money off of what I shared with you. And I want some of that, right? You don't want to deal with that unnecessarily. And so that way, and that's, and that really just sort of as a general principle that I share with my clients and with my audience is that you really want to be proactive when it comes to protecting your intellectual property and protecting your business. You don't want to deal with doing that damage control later on or having to deal with a lawsuit or hiring, you know, a lawyer to defend you in that sort of case. You really, it suits you best as a business owner so that you're able to preserve your energies and focus that on developing your business and really operating within your zone of genius instead of having to invest that in, okay, well, let me clean up this mess that could have been avoided.
Well, how do we find that balance, though? I feel like, I mean, I'm kind of putting it all out there. I've done almost 700 episodes over 13 years. I haven't had an issue yet, but now you're making me think maybe I should hire a lawyer, have someone fill out like a little DocuSign before they do the show.
Yeah.
But then I might turn them off, right? I mean, we as regular people, and I'm not trying to other you as a lawyer, but mm-hmm. you know, we the regular non-lawyers see a contract and we're like, oh, I don't want to do your podcast because you're going to make me sign something. It's like when your friend says, hey, let's have coffee, but sign this NDA first. And it's like, well, you know, either we're friends or we sign an NDA, but not both. Do I need a contract for doing podcasts?
Are you required to have one by the law? No. Would it benefit you and benefit the other party to clearly outline what the relationship is? Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. That can help mitigate, disagreements or miscommunications that
or even hard feelings
later on. Exactly. Or even hard feelings, and making sure that it's very clear what's taking place here. And we see this a lot, in the legal business world, is that people kind of, we just operate based on a handshake or I'll take mm-hmm. your word for it. But then later on, things aren't as clear as they were when we actually said them, right? Like, mm-hmm. wait a second, I thought we agreed to this, but no, I thought we agreed to that. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, how are we going to know what was agreed to? And then all of a sudden, it's this whole dispute, and that may or may not lead to, worst case litigation and having to deal with it for years and years in the courts, and it's very expensive, mm-hmm. The opposite end of the spectrum, which is also like not ideal, but you ruin the relationship and you lose that relationship. And so instead, this isn't legal advice by any means, but as a general rule of thumb, having a contract in any type of business relationship, certainly will benefit you as the business owner, as the mm-hmm. podcast host, as the program director or a course developer or an instructor on that, whatever it is. If you're entering mm-hmm. into a business relationship, my general recommendation is you want to make sure that it's in writing what the terms of the relationship are. How will decisions be made if it is a partnership? How is compensation going to be, made if money is changing hands and if services are being exchanged? And then that way you can, move forward in confidence and not have to worry mm. about any type of miscommunication or disagreement or dispute cropping up.
Okay. And then, of course, it's flexible. Like there isn't like, and we're using this podcast as an example here mm-hmm. of copyright, but certainly I wouldn't have to have it written in my favor. It could actually be something where the guest would say, hey, Scott wants to make sure that you know as my guest that you own your words. And if you want to make t-shirts of your words, that I can't do that. Like I could actually flip it around and make it so they'd be happy that they were signing it.
So that's actually and that's a great point that you bring up, Scott, is that is actually the way I prefer to draft my contracts with my clients. And I don't do contract drafting so much anymore, but it used to be a significant part of my practice, is that the contract is there. And you should frame it this way when you're approaching. So, for example, within the context of this podcast, I'm presenting it to you because it's in both of our best interests, right? So it clearly mm-hmm. states what, my rights are, what your rights are, or what, as we're entering into this business relationship, your position and my position. And a good contract should not harm one and benefit the other, because we're obviously mm-hmm. entering into this contract to move forward in a business relationship or some sort of relationship. Right. And so I'm not creating this contract, to disadvantage you. Instead, it should be to clearly state the terms of our relationship, and make it clear what we're moving forward based on. Mm-hmm. And so you could, and you should say in a contract like that, just as a general rule of thumb, is that, you as the podcast guest are granting a license to the host, to use, your voice or your likeness or whatever it might be in connection with the promotional, materials, in connection mm-hmm. with that podcast. And then also you as the guest maintain ownership over your, words or contribution or however you end mm-hmm. up stating it. And just sort of as a note on that.
Interesting. A big thank you to our sponsors because they make this show possible, and I hope that you support them the way they support us. Progress Software is the creator of the most comprehensive developer toolkit for building modern apps on the market today, Telerik DevCraft. With more than 1,100 Telerik.NET and Kendo UI JavaScript components and controls, you can easily build modern, high-performance web, mobile, and desktop apps, as well as chatbots. The toolset also includes reporting solutions, automated testing and productivity tools, and comes with a range of support options. New this year is a free online training program for all license holders. With this, alongside thousands of demos and source code available, comprehensive documentation, and a full assortment of Visual Studio templates, you'll be up and running with the Progress Telerik and Kendo UI controls in no time. Download a free 30-day trial today at Telerik.com/Hanselman. That's Telerik.com/Hanselman. So you made this statement a couple times, granting a license too. So you always own your words because you said them, but you are allowing me to rebroadcast them. I've heard that before when I put things on Facebook or when I put things in what I call walled gardens. Like, owning a blog is my blog. I own the copyright. I host it. It's my text and I own the server. So I own everything, basically. But Facebook, I type some words, or even if I type like a chapter of a book that I haven't written yet, I didn't just give them the entire chapter of the book. I granted them a license to display it again. Is that correct?
Yes. So I have not read Facebook's terms of use.
But the general idea of content.
Yeah. But content generally, if I am, let's say, and this is my presumption with Facebook, mm-hmm. because I don't think Facebook could operate unless they did include the way it does, unless they did include this type of license. I'm thinking that when we upload photos to Facebook or to Twitter or Instagram or, you know, any other type of online platform where mm-hmm. it is reproduced, we likely in the terms of use, they state you as the user mm-hmm. maintain copyright ownership over your content, because you must expressly transfer a copyright to the other party, right, in order for them to become the owner of it. So you as the original creator of that work, you own the copyright and you maintain the copyright. However, you're granting Facebook or whatever platform it is a license to reproduce it, and otherwise you could not use Facebook the way that we're using Facebook, right? So I share photos to Facebook, I maintain ownership, but in order for Facebook to be able to produce that on other individuals' feeds and, you know, just online generally or in searches or however it is that they work, they would need a license to be able to do that. And so, I'm thinking that's probably what takes place in their very long terms of use document.
No, I'm sure. And I realize that it's unreasonable to expect you or anyone to, unless they are a Facebook-specific lawyer. But I'm kind of using Facebook as a generic term for social media, walled gardens in general. I think it's subtle. Like, I don't think my non-technical parents understand that there is an implicit terms of service for that. You know, everyone just clicks OK on the terms of service, and we don't realize that we have signed a copyright over or a trademark over by simply passively using something, which is a little bit scary. Which also brings me to the question, like, if I need a lawyer to understand something, maybe I shouldn't be using the thing at all. I'm trying to find that balance between being paralyzed with confusion about these things and versus being able to move through the digital world with confidence. And then also whether or not I want to just go to LegalZoom or one of these websites and go through a wizard, or if I need to go and pay, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to talk to a lawyer. I realize these are all false equivalencies, but this can cause someone to kind of have analysis paralysis and then choose to basically do nothing. Yeah. So I guess my question is, people are probably doing nothing, and in doing that, maybe not protecting themselves.
Yeah, I think there are so many different aspects of this, Scott, and you hit the nail on the head in that there is analysis paralysis when it comes to decision-making in businesses, when it comes to their legal protections and the legal foundation. I think it is somewhat of an intimidating process to begin. You know, I know I need some legal advice. I know I'm not totally clear. I did a couple Google searches and I don't really want to like Frankenstein a whole contract for my business together based on what I can cut and paste. But, you know, how much, what kind of lawyer do I even need? How much is it going to cost? You know, is it going to cost me an arm and a leg? I don't have $10,000+ to invest in a lawyer right now or legal services right now. So maybe I'll just do nothing. And it's a really hard position to be in because there isn't, with a lot of these things, there aren't laws in place requiring you, for example, as a business owner to, you know, take these steps. You have to have a contract in place, or you have to have your trademark protected, or you have to file for a patent. There isn't anything requiring these individuals to do that. So they can continue to operate their business outside of that. And then once it catches up to them, then at that point, they have to hire a lawyer to defend them, to develop their legal foundation, to form an entity, to draft a contract, whatever it might be, right? And so your question was, the first part of that question was, you know, how do I, is it dangerous for me to just be using these different tools online or, you know, even Facebook, you know, something as basic as Facebook and as commonplace as Facebook. You know, if I don't understand the legal implications of clicking agree under their terms of use when I create an account, should I even be using it? So, again, this is not legal advice, just generally speaking.
Nothing in this podcast.
Yeah, nothing in this podcast is legal advice, purely for informational purposes. But just generally speaking, there is a there's a doctrine in contract law, and it's all about unconscionability. Okay, so the average person does not, you know, read through every single word in a terms of use. I mean, I'm an attorney and I do not read through when my Apple computer has an update, which is like, feels like every other day it has an update. I don't read through that. I click agree and I move on and everything is fine. And, you know, I just hope for the best. Now, if there were to be something, for example, I'm, you know, transferring ownership of my you know, homestead in those terms, or, you know, I agreed to let them have my firstborn child in the event that I, you know, whatever the terms might say, unconscionability means that that provision, if it is not right or just or reasonable, or if it's unreasonably excessive, it will be disregarded. So a court would not enforce. Yeah, a court would not enforce.
If they snuck in something.
Yes.
Every once in a while it updates. And it's like, okay, if you click okay, you've given Apple your car. That's unconscionable.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes, exactly. That's unreasonable. You know, the average person would not expect that to be within a software update, right? And so, and I mean, I can't guarantee that would be the case in every single contract. Maybe, you know, reasonable minds may differ. Right. And that's why we have the courts work things like that out. But yeah, generally speaking, if I'm, you know, using Facebook or using Google or using some sort of software, best practice, absolute best practice is to be clear on what it is you're agreeing to. And certainly if you're entering into a long-term commitment or a long-term business relationship, you want to be clear on what those terms are that you're agreeing to, and having a lawyer review that contract is a great decision to make just because a lawyer can decipher, you know, what is in all this fine print and what will be required of me as a party in this agreement. But if this is just a general terms of use that, you know, it's a software license or, you know, I'm creating an account on a social media platform, I wouldn't be paralyzed from fear of, you know, agreeing to their terms of use. But yeah, it's just something to keep in mind.
Another thing that we talked about beforehand that I wanted to cover in this show was the idea, if I'm working on a project and I'm like a small business and then I'm hiring other small businesses to make me like a logo or write me, you know, punch up some text or something like that. Do I pay you and you make me a logo and then you email me the logo? Did you own the logo? Do I own the logo? But the assumption is I just paid you, I own the logo, but you could come back 10 years from now and say, yeah, I made that logo. Yeah, he paid me, but I still own it. Or if I hire someone to take photos, they own them, right? They could still sell them again.
Yes, exactly. And that is something that so many business owners just don't understand and aren't familiar with, this concept of work for hire in terms of copyright ownership. And so if I hired a designer to develop a logo for me, they are the original author of that design, that graphic design. And so even though I paid them to provide me with the logo, I might have provided them with all the inspiration necessary to develop the design. They still have created it themselves. And so they maintain copyright ownership of it. And that means they have that bundle of sticks that we were talking about, of rights. And so they could license it to others. They could tweak it and create derivative works based on it. And by providing it to me and by my hiring of them, I have sort of an implied license to the use of it. But they're still able to turn around. And that's what I see a lot of people experiencing. And they're like, what the hell? Like, I didn't say you could sell that to somebody else. But the designer will turn around and sell that design to another business for them to use as their logo. And so it's really important to make sure that when you are hiring someone to develop some work of art or authorship, so maybe I hire a copywriter to develop written blogs for my website. Maybe I hire a photographer to develop photos or a videographer to, you know, shoot video footage, or a graphic designer to develop some graphic designs. You want to make sure that there's a copyright transfer agreement that is signed that clearly and expressly transfers ownership of it. And that way you are the one that owns it and are able to license it to others, are able to reproduce it, are able to use it in any which way you wish, instead of being limited by, you know, the ownership of another.
Interesting. The thing that was most significant about what you said there was the idea of implicit versus explicit. There's an implicit license, and we can all assume that, but if it doesn't get written down, it's not real.
Within copyright ownership, a transfer of the rights must be explicit. It must be express. We can't assume that. However, when I hire you to take photos, it can be implied that I intend to use that, right? Otherwise, I wouldn't have hired you. But it can't be implied that the copyright ownership is being transferred to me unless we have that in writing and agreed to by both parties.
Interesting. And this gets to the root of what we were talking about, where people are just counting on handshakes. They're counting on assumptions. Yep. They're counting on implicit rights.
Yes. Yeah, that's where it gets to be problematic. Specifically, when it comes to trademark law and protection of your trademark assets, a lot of people think, well, you know, I hired someone to develop my logo or my whole brand identity based on this name or based on this inspiration that I provided them. And they said it should be fine. They haven't seen anything like it. And they move forward based on that sort of blind faith, I guess. And I'm not really sure why they would, but I guess it's a matter of you don't know what you don't know, right? Yeah, and when you don't know what you don't know, you don't even know what questions to ask. You don't know where to look. You don't know who to consult with. And so what I see a lot of people within the trademark space doing is they'll move forward and develop their whole business and their whole brand based on a name, based on a product name, based on a slogan or a logo or whatever it might be. And then they get hit with a cease and desist, or they get hit with an infringement lawsuit because somebody else is already using a name that is similar to it. And just because it's not exactly the same doesn't mean there isn't a situation, a possible situation of infringement there. So it's something to keep in mind.
I appreciate that. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today. And people can engage with you, right, at yshfirm.com, and you can advise them. And this is literally what you do, what you've talked about with me on the show about getting people started and making sure that they're protected and they're successful in their startups is literally what you do.
Absolutely. And it would be my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Scott.
Fantastic. I've been talking with Yasmin Salem-Hamdan, and this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. And we'll see you again next week.